Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Crash victims remains alive in the Netherlands and dozens trapped feared dead in Taiwan plane crash. I'm Bob Doty, reporting from Washington. Two military planes carrying the remains of some victims of last week's downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 have arrived in the Netherlands, where citizens are observing a national day of mourning. The Dutch and Australian planes touched down at Eindhoven Air Base Wednesday, where dignitaries had gathered on the tarmac. Mourners lay flowers at the airbase to pay their respects, and flags flew at half-staff. The bodies are to be taken to a site near the town of Hilversum to begin the process of identification. All 298 people on board the Malaysian plane were killed, most of them Dutch citizens. U.S. officials say it was probably brought down last week by pro-Russian separatists firing a Russian surface-to-air missile. They say that ill-trained rebels likely shot down the plane by mistake. Dozens are believed to be dead following the crash of a TransAsia Airways flight in Taiwan. Authorities say 47 people are trapped in the wreckage and presumed dead on an island between the Chinese mainland and Taiwan. Reports say another 11 survived and have been taken to a nearby hospital. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is having separate talks with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on ending violence in the Gaza Strip that has killed more than 600 people. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns is traveling with the secretary and has this report.
With Israeli and Hamas forces continuing to fight in Gaza, Secretary Kerry says there's been some progress in moving toward a ceasefire during the past 24 hours, but he did not specify the nature of that progress. Secretary Kerry was up much of the night in telephone diplomacy with Palestinian President Abbas, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, and the foreign ministers of Qatar, Turkey, France, and Egypt. He came to Israel and Ramallah to meet face-to-face with Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas to press an Egyptian ceasefire plan that Hamas rejected last week because it offers no guaranteed relief from the Israeli and Egyptian blockade of Gaza. Asked about a possible demilitarization of Gaza as part of a negotiated settlement, Kerry said all of the issues of Gaza will be on the table. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Ramallah.
A popular Somali singer who was also a member of parliament has been killed by Islamist militants. A pro-militant website says al-Qaeda-linked al-Shabaab was responsible for Wednesday's shooting of Saadu Ali Warsame outside the Ambassador Hotel in Mogadishu. A witness told VOA that gunmen in a car shot her several times in the chest, then fled. Warsame was a well-known singer who was formerly based in the U.S. city of Minneapolis. In 2012, she returned to Somalia and became one of the few women in the country's new parliament. She's the fourth member of parliament killed by al-Shabaab this year. A pair of explosions have rocked the northern Nigerian city of Kaduna, killing at least 25 people. Police say a bomb apparently targeted the convoy of moderate Muslim cleric Sheikh Dahiru Bauchi, who had just finished preaching in a public square. The cleric escaped unharmed, but at least 25 people were killed. The second explosion took place in a crowded Kaduna market. There are unconfirmed reports of casualties. Former Army General Prabowo Subianto, who lost Indonesia's presidential election, has decided to challenge the result at the country's constitutional court. The move was announced by his spokesman on Wednesday, day after the Election Commission named his rival, ex-Jakarta Governor Joko Widodo, the winner of the July 9th vote. The court challenge should take about a month to complete. Most analysts think it will prove unsuccessful. Typhoon Matmo has made landfall in southern China, the second major storm to hit the country in a week. Winds gusted to 108 kilometers per hour as it swept over heavily populated Fujian province on Wednesday. And the UN Humanitarian Office is directing $75 million in emergency aid to 11 African countries where increasing numbers are struggling with hunger and malnutrition. A UN release Wednesday said the biggest portion, that's $20 million, will go to Somalia, where drought, conflict, and soaring prices have left nearly 3 million people short of adequate food. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiswu Heben. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Nigerians are marking the 100th day since more than 200 girls were kidnapped from their schoolhouse in the war-torn northeast. While the abduction sparked international outrage and support, the girls appear to be no closer to home than they were 100 days ago.
That's VOA's Heather Murdoch reporting from Abuja. Details next.
Also in the news, gunmen in Somalia's capital have shot dead a member of parliament, the fourth Somali lawmaker killed in Mogadishu this year.
We'll have these stories plus sports with Peter Kloti, music from Somalia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, a popular Somali singer who was also a member of parliament has been killed by Islamist militants. A pro-militant website says Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab was responsible for today's shooting of Sado Ali Wasami outside the Ambassador Hotel in Mogadishu. A witness told VOA that gunmen in a car shot her several times in the chest, then fled. Wasami was a well-known singer who was formerly based in the U.S. city of Minneapolis. In 2012, she returned to Somalia and became one of the few women in the country's new parliament. She is the fourth member of parliament killed by Al-Shabaab this year. In a separate incident, Al-Shabaab has executed a teenage girl who the militant group accused of spying for the government. Fartoon Abdel Nasir Mohammed was executed by firing squad in the town of Dinsor. The girl's father told VOA that his daughter was 13 years old and denied that she was a spy.
Nigerians are marking the 100th day since more than 200 girls were kidnapped from their schoolhouse in the war-torn northeast. For VOA, Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja that while the abduction sparked international outrage and support, the girls appear to be no closer to home than they were 100 days ago.
In 5 years of Boko Haram insurgency and thousands of deaths in northeastern Nigeria, no crime has angered people in other parts of the country and around the world like the kidnapping of the girls on April 14th. Two weeks after the abduction, on a rainy afternoon, activists in Nigeria took to the streets, demanding the immediate rescue of the girls. Michelle Obama and Angelina Jolie expressed support for the movement that later became known as Bring Back Our Girls, and countries around the world pledged to help. 2 months after the abduction, rallies continued almost every day, and U.S. lawmakers visited Nigeria, adding their voices to the call for the girls' rescue. Congresswoman Frederica Wilson.
Mothers and sisters, wives, girls, grandmothers, and all of the men, we stand with the men, are pleading for the release of these girls, and it's not too late.
3 months after the abduction, Pakistani girls' education activist Malala Yousafzai came to Abuja to speak with Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, who told her his government was doing everything possible to find the girls.
There are some difficulties which he mentioned, such as that it's quite difficult to do a military operation as these girls can be targeted. There is an idea of swapping, but there are it's quite complicated situation to understand.
She says the president promised to rescue the girls as soon as possible. And 100 days after the abduction, the public still knows nothing certain about the girls' condition or their whereabouts. The only information comes from Boko Haram's leader, who said in a video they are being held captive as slaves and will not be returned unless the government swaps imprisoned militants for girls. This is Obi Ezekwelizi, one of the leaders of Bring Back Our Girls.
The sad thing is that the conversation between the citizens and our government leaves a lot to be desired.
Activists say they continue to plan near daily sit-outs in Abuja until the girls are rescued. But the group and the kidnapped girls are also now in the center of Nigerian politics, with the government accusing Bring Back Our Girls of being agents of the opposition. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Ten minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The head of the African Union peacekeeping force in the Central African Republic says partition of the nation into a Muslim North and a Christian South is not up for discussion now. The AU's Jean-Marie Michael Makoko was responding to a demand made yesterday in Brazzaville by Seleka General Mohamed Musa Dafane. The general said partition would formalize the split after tens of thousands of Muslims had fled the South. The Seleka demand came as a surprise at the Forum for National Reconciliation and Political Dialogue for the Central African Republic. The forum is a three-day meeting of more than 160 delegates from the CAR transitional government, civil society, armed groups, and representatives from the African Union, the United Nations, France, the European Union, and the United States. Thousands have been killed and more than a million forced from their homes in recent months of sectarian violence. Seleka fighters seized power in the majority Christian country in March 2013. Christian militias called anti-Balaka then formed to combat Seleka attacks. They have forced thousands of Muslims to evacuate the country.
The U.S. Attorney's Office has charged a teenager with sexually abusing children in Kenya. Matthew Lane Durham of Edmond, Oklahoma, who's 19, is charged with the sexual abuse of children between the ages of 4 and 10 years of age while working in a Nairobi home for neglected and disabled children. Durham was arrested July 17th and is being held without bond. A hearing is scheduled for August 1st. If convicted, Durham faces life in prison. The U.S. Attorney's Office alleges that Durham engaged in sexual acts with multiple children at the Apendo Children's Home in the Kenyan capital. The trial will take place in Oklahoma City. No word on whether Kenya might request the defendant's extradition for trial in Kenya courts.
The U.S. ambassador to Australia says it should not be a crime to be a member of the LGBT community. Ambassador John Barry told the 20th International AIDS Conference that the fight against the disease cannot be won by relegating segments of the population to the shadows. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Ambassador Barry says the world has reached a critical moment in the fight against HIV/AIDS.
We are now on the brink of an AIDS-free generation. But reaching that goal will depend on all of us working together and being able to get the preventative care and treatment that everyone needs.
However, he says, there are many barriers around the world blocking access to prevention, care, and treatment.
Unfortunately, the criminalization of certain at-risk populations and those who are HIV positive and the stigma associated with HIV are the very things that will prevent us from eliminating this disease entirely.
The U.S. ambassador says criminalization is bad health policy and bad public policy. He says it does not stop the spread of HIV/AIDS and, in fact, does just the opposite.
Criminalization laws undermine public health approaches that we need to fight this disease and limit its spread. These laws don't reflect current scientific knowledge. They undermine our ability to get people into screening and treatment. And more fundamentally, these laws wrongly stigmatize and marginalize those living with HIV and AIDS.
More than 80 countries around the world have criminal laws against sexual activity by lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Some of those laws contain very harsh penalties. The International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association says 13 U.S. states still have not repealed their anti-sodomy laws. That's despite a 2003 ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court declaring such laws unconstitutional. The Center for HIV Law and Policy says 32 states and two U.S. territories have HIV-specific criminal statutes, and 36 states have reported proceedings in which HIV-positive people have been arrested and/or prosecuted for consensual sex, biting, and spitting. The center says there have been at least 80 such prosecutions in the last 2 years alone. Ambassador Berry says the U.S. still has more to do in this regard.
Now, while the United States still has laws that criminalize HIV status, we are working to become better, to do better, and to remedy our mistakes. We believe that one of the most productive public policy actions that we can take is removing outdated criminalization laws from the books. The president, in his national HIV/AIDS strategy, has called for the review and reform of all HIV criminalization laws across our country.
Ambassador Berry calls that a good step, but adds more needs to be done at home and abroad. He notes that new HIV infections are on the rise in the United States and the AIDS conference host country, Australia, particularly among young men.
Those of us who remember the funerals of the 80s and 90s have no wish to repeat that era. It falls to us to ensure that the next generation does not repeat these mistakes.
He says that means educating young people about HIV prevention and transmission, supporting research, lifting travel restrictions on those living with HIV, and supporting the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. Berry also praised PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, for helping to get 6.7 million people on treatment. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Gunmen in Somalia's capital have shot dead a member of parliament, the fourth Somali lawmaker killed in Mogadishu this year. And the Nigerians are marking the 100th day since more than 200 girls were kidnapped from their schoolhouse in the war-torn Northeast. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says officials working on a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas have made some steps forward toward ending a conflict that has left hundreds of people dead. He spoke today after arriving in Israel for talks on how to end the violence. Kerry is meeting with United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He will also hold talks with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah. Mr. Ban held talks with Israeli President Shimon Peres and said there is no time to lose in finding a ceasefire with the death toll rising by the hour. The Israeli military continued hitting the Gaza Strip with airstrikes today, killing at least three people. More than 630 Palestinians have been killed since Israel launched its campaign to halt rocket fire from Hamas militants in Gaza.
The Ukrainian Defense Ministry says two of its military fighter jets have been shot down in eastern Ukraine. A spokesman for the Defense Ministry said today that the planes were shot down in Savur Mogila. No details were known about the pilots of the plane. Meanwhile, a Dutch military plane carrying the bodies of victims of last week's Malaysia Airlines crash has arrived in the Netherlands after leaving the city of Kharkiv earlier yesterday. The Dutch government declared today a national mourning.
The crash last Thursday killed all 298 people on board, most of them Dutch citizens. There was confusion about how many corpses were on the train, which arrived in Kharkiv from rebel-controlled territory yesterday. Pro-Russian rebels accused of downing the plane said Monday that they had released 282 bodies and the parts of 16 others. But Dutch forensic team leader Jan Tunder said the refrigerated rail cars contained only 200 bodies. Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott said today some of the crash victims may have been left behind at the crash site. Meanwhile, Britain says it has taken delivery of two flight data recorders from the flight. U.S. officials say Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was probably shot down last week by pro-Russian separatists firing a Russian SA-11 surface-to-air missile, and that ill-trained rebels likely downed the plane by mistake. U.S. intelligence officials said they have no evidence of direct Russian involvement in the shootdown.
The push for equal gender representation, known as 50-50, gained momentum in Malawi's recent election campaign, but did not produce the expected results. The May 20th election actually saw a significant drop in the number of women elected, with only 32 seats in parliament going to women as opposed to 43 in 2009. The stats are worse in local races. Malawi ranks among the countries with the lowest female representation. Lamech Messina reports from Blantyre.
Gender activists say the poor performance of women candidates in the May elections was shocking, and they have not yet determined the cause. Emma Garia is the national coordinator for the NGO Gender Coordinating Network, which championed the campaign.
I don't think we've been able to establish any reasons why women may have performed this marriage during the election. Basically, what I can say is that all what was supposed to be done was done, and therefore we did not expect to have the numbers that we got eventually.
Throughout the campaign, her organization was providing financial, material, and more support to all the women candidates, regardless of political party affiliation. In addition, the more than 250 women candidates for parliament and 2,000 women campaigning as councillors were trained in public speaking techniques and skills on how to attract voters. But this did not work to the expectations of the campaigners. Garia says changes are needed in Malawi electoral system. She says the country should have a proportional representation in which each party presents its list of candidates and receives seats in proportion to its overall share of the national vote. Garia says African countries like South Africa, Mozambique, and Uganda use a proportional representation system that has helped increase the number of women in decision-making positions. The chairperson of the Women's Caucus in Malawi Parliament, Jessica Bwira, says she believes the way Malawi's President Joyce Banda performed in office may have influenced some voters not to vote for any woman candidate.
The fact that we had a woman president who became synonymous with cash gate and lots of, governance failures, that impacted standing as a woman in this election.
President Banda was highly criticized for allowing the scandal to happen under her administration. The scandal prompted major donors to suspend their financial support to the country. But Principal Secretary in the Ministry of Gender, Children and Disability and Social Welfare, Mary Shawa, blames the dismal performance of women during the polls on the patriarchal nature of Malawi society, which she says looks down upon women.
People who vote people into power are the people who are in the village. And within their cultures, there are aspects that they believe in. So if in my culture, the belief is a woman cannot be my boss, I will not vote for the woman. It's not a question of the ministry. It's about every Malawi. How do they view and look at a woman? It's the ordinary chief in the village. How does she or he look at a woman?
She says the fight for equal representation of men and women in decision-making positions will not be won unless society changes its perception towards women. Meanwhile, the gender activists in Malawi are expected to hold a conference in August to discuss what went wrong for women in the elections. The delegates also are expected to plot the strategy for the country's 2019 elections. Lamech Messina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Attracted by the scholarships and the dream of an overseas education, students from Africa have turned to China as their lab to gain an edge in knowledge and experience. Their numbers are fast increasing in the tens of thousands annually. Officially, China awards scholarships for the skills development Africa most needs. But it's also a way to strengthen its soft power on the continent. Most of the students enjoy the experience, but some Africans also complain about the quality of education. Benno Mutchler brings us this report he researched with Yiting Sun on their recent trip to China.
On a chilly April day in Shanghai, Zambian student Violet Valya sat down in a cafe near Tongji University, one of the top schools in the country. It was lunchtime, and the cafeteria on campus offered a variety of Chinese dishes. But the college freshman said she cooks her homestyle food herself most of the time. She enrolled in Tongji University under a Chinese government scholarship in September 2013. She didn't know she would see so many people just like her.
Yes, I didn't expect so much Africans to be here. So when I came, I was shocked.
The wide-eyed 19-year-old Zambian was also amazed by China's development visible everywhere on the street.
Yeah, the infrastructure are so cool, the roads, everything is just cool, I don't know. Our country really has tall buildings.
Like so many other African students on Chinese government scholarships, Violet Valya will spend her first year learning the language and then go to another university to study her major, medicine. All classes will be taught in Mandarin. African students who have been in China for a longer time say the language barrier can render the entire academic program just a process to receive a piece of paper.
Generally, I think the biggest challenge for an international student who comes to China to study English, an English course, is availability of lecturers who can actually speak English.
That's an African master student in Wuhan, central China, who studies in English. He wanted to remain anonymous because he didn't want to be heard criticizing Chinese education publicly. He said that his professors can't answer his questions because they don't speak English and he doesn't speak much Chinese either. His friend complained that it's too easy for Africans to get a pass.
Where I come from, you're really pushed by getting good grades. Yeah. You're not going to get a 90 by just showing up or just going to the exam. But here, when you come, they just give you 90s. For them, it's like you want the paper. And so they give you the paper and you go home.
Most African students, however, think positively of their experience in China. Juma Salum from Zanzibar, Tanzania, is pursuing a PhD in political science at Shanghai's International Studies University. Despite the challenging cold weather, he enjoys his studies very much. Like most African students in China, he wants to return after graduation to help his country.
I feel I have a burden to return to my country. And the most things to do, to work hard with the government, to support my government, to support my society, and to be a link between the Chinese people and Tanzania people and African people.
And Juma Salum is setting a trend that is growing exponentially. In 2012, China's Department of Foreign Assistance at the Ministry of Commerce said it hosted more than 27,000 students from Africa. By the end of 2013, there were over 35,000 African students in China. Benno Möchler with Yiting Sun for VOA News, Shanghai.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Yeah. Feel
like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Gunmen in Somalia's capital have shot dead a member of parliament, the fourth Somali lawmaker killed in Mogadishu this year. And Nigerians are marking the 100th day since more than 200 schoolgirls were kidnapped from their schoolhouse in the northeast. Coming up, we have music from Somalia. And in our feature segment, our special VOA Presents series on AIDS. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Peter Cloti sitting in for the vacationing Sonny Young. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Kim.
Well, I understand that Commonwealth Games begin today.
Indeed, it is.
Okay.
The opening ceremony of the British Commonwealth Games begins in the Scottish capital, Glasgow, this evening. About 4,500 athletes from 71 nations will take part in the 20th edition of the Games, which run until August 3rd. The five big names appearing at the Games or the competition include Jamaica's sprinter Usain Bolt, who will be competing in the 4x100-meter relay, England's runner Mo Farah, who will compete in the 5,000-meter and 10,000-meter races. Sprinter Shirley Ann Fraser-Pryce from Jamaica will be competing in the 100-meter dash. England cyclist Sir Bradley Wiggins will compete in the team pursuit. An English diver, Tom Daly, will be competing in 10-meter individual event at the Commonwealth Games. And now here is Daybreak Africa Sports editor Mark Ouma with today's sports news roundup. Take it away, Mark.
Ugandan Joshua Cheptegei won the first medal at the IAAF World Junior Athletics Championships in Eugene, Oregon State, United States of America on Tuesday. Cheptegei clocked 28 minutes and 32.86 seconds to triumph in the men's 10,000 meters, the only final on the first day of the championships. Kenyan Elvis Cheboi and Nicholas Kosimbei followed to claim the silver and bronze medals respectively, while Roblen Jan Aden set a Djibouti national junior record of 29 minutes and 43.49 seconds. Staying in Eugene, Nigerian Bashiru Abdullahi and Ghana's Yakubu Ibrahim each set their respective national junior men's 110-meter hurdles record. Abdullahi clocked 14.04 seconds while Ibrahim ran 14.61 seconds. Later, Mzamo Mgomezulu set a Swaziland junior men's record in the 100 meters in a time of 10.84 seconds. In football, Tunisia's under-23 team pipped their peers and hosts Qatar by a solitary goal in Doha on Tuesday. The two sides are preparing for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympic football qualifiers. Elsewhere, the Algerian national football team players have donated $100,000 to help alleviate the suffering of children in the Gaza Strip in Palestine, the Algeria Football Federation revealed in Algiers. The children are trapped in the crossfire between the Israeli army and Hamas militants in over 2 weeks of fierce fighting in the Gaza Strip. The Algerian players noted that fans in Gaza supported Algeria's campaign during the recent FIFA World Cup in Brazil, where Africa's highest placed nation on the FIFA rankings progressed beyond the group stage for the first time in four outings at the World Cup. Finally, 18 African nations are among 71 countries and territories that have converged in Glasgow, Scotland for the 2014 British Commonwealth Games. African teams that will file through the opening ceremony today, Wednesday, are Botswana, Cameroon, Ghana, Lesotho, Kenya, Malawi, Mauritius, Mozambique, and Namibia. Others are Nigeria, Rwanda, Seychelles, Sierra Leone, South Africa, Swaziland, Tanzania, Uganda, Uganda and Zambia. Over the next 11 days, sportsmen and women are vying for medals in athletics, badminton, boxing, cycling, diving, gymnastics, hockey, judo, lawn bowls, netball, powerlifting, rugby, shooting, squash, swimming, triathlon, table tennis, weightlifting, and wrestling.
Mark Ouma is Daybreak Africa Sports Editor, reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Have a good day, Mark. In football news, Germany's World Cup winning coach Joachim Löw says he will remain in the post until at least the 2016 European Championship in France. There were reports that Löw could step down after Germany won the World Cup in Brazil with a 1-0 victory over Argentina. The 54-year-old Löw, who extended his contract until after the European Championship, replaced Jürgen Klinsmann in 2006 after being an assistant coach for 2 years. Löw said he needed some time to come to terms with his emotions after the World Cup, but had not thought even for a second about stepping down. It has been 5 years since Spain's La Liga giant Barcelona signed a centre-back, but with the arrival of Jeremy Mathieu, the hope is that a troublesome gap has finally been filled. Jeremy Mathieu, capped twice by France, has joined Barcelona from Valencia in a reported $27 million deal. The former Toulouse defender becomes the club's fifth signing of the summer under new coach Luis Enrique, following the arrivals of Marc-Andre ter Stegen from German side Borussia Mönchengladbach, Ivan Rakitic from Sevilla, Claudio Bravo from Real Sociedad, and Luis Suarez from English club Liverpool. DC United, the soccer team in the nation's capital, will soon have a new stadium. VOA's Daniel Brown conducted an interview with Craig Stouffer, the director of communications for DC United, to talk about the new stadium that is under construction in Washington, D.C.
The main goal for the stadium is certainly, the team has been in Washington, D.C. for nearly 2 decades. It's a 50-year-old building that's outdated in many ways, and DC United is looking to commit itself to the city for the foreseeable future. And the best way to do that is to have a new venue that is more appropriately sized and that has a lot of the sponsorship and revenue-generating opportunities that modern stadiums have these days, including suites and billboards, a lot of the modern amenities that we just don't have at RFK.
So how much would this stadium cost?
$150 million in assembling land and providing the infrastructure, basically those kinds of costs that they would cover for any sort of development in the area where we'd like to build. And then the stadium is projected to cost $150 million in construction as well. And that would be privately financed by the team.
So where would the stadium actually be located? The
proposed location is a couple blocks southwest of where Nationals Park is in southwest Washington, just across South Capitol Street, sort of at the corners of the southwest waterfront and the Anacostia. So location is ideal to help sort of bridge the gap between a couple different developments where Nationals Park is and Navy Yard on the southwest waterfront. It would create a complete an entertainment district, which is a rapidly growing and developing area of the city.
Yeah, that's actually a great place to actually put a stadium, by the way. Just a great atmosphere over there. What will the name of the stadium be?
Certainly haven't gotten to that level just yet. I think once and approved by the D.C. Council, certainly some of those conversations will begin in earnest.
So have you put your name in that pot so far, like the Craig Stadium?
I don't have the corporate base myself to support that.
So when you guys created the stadium, is there any kind of stadiums you guys looked into before creating this one?
The team has done a lot of work examining the best practices and soccer-specific venues within Major League Soccer, and certainly some venues in Europe as well. There's no stadium in the country that has the prospect of being brand new and purpose-built in this kind of an urban setting. So there are some similarities to Providence Park, where the Portland Timbers play. That stadium is a retrofitted facility that's been around for a long time. Houston has an urban facility, but that city doesn't draw on transit the way that Washington, D.C. does. And Chicago's soccer-specific stadium is in a suburb. Even New York's Red Bull Arena is outside of Manhattan. So what we're really excited about is the prospect for this stadium to be kind of dramatically urban setting for a brand new venue in the country.
Yeah, because I was going to say, it kind of reminds me like an overseas stadium, and it kind of gives like the new flavor into D.C. How are the D.C. United fans reacting to the stadium?
I think they're so excited. I mean, for the, you know, D.C. United set the table for the league in the league's early years with an organically grown supporter culture that's diverse and dedicated to the success of the team. And for the longest time, you know, they've been clamoring for a park that, you know, that matches their kind of ambitions as well. So I think their reaction has been super positive, and they're excited to have a venue all their own, and a place that they can really that they know will reflect the team and the city.
Yeah. What about the players too? How are they reacting to this?
You know, it's difficult for the players because, you know, players, they don't have the time to get too caught up in something like this that is about city development. You know, they have games to play week in and week out, and they're fighting for their lives and for their jobs and things like that. So I certainly would imagine that whoever is on the roster at the time will be extremely excited and really welcoming for the opportunity to open a new venue.
Will this stadium create more jobs in D.C.?
Yeah, certainly the stadium itself is projected to create jobs for D.C., and certainly the stadium is projected to create a new source of tax revenue for the city, and that's part of the process of what we've been trying to relay to the D.C. Council as they deliberate over the details of the package. And that's part of our message to get out to the community, that this is a positive development. It's about jobs, and it's about tax revenue, and it's about creating a better place, for the citizens of this city and for the citizens of the region. And it's not just about a venue for DC United, but a venue that can host different kinds of events like concerts and collegiate sports, soccer, rugby, lacrosse, those kinds of things as well. This kind of venue really doesn't exist in DC, and the prospect of having a 20,000 seat will give the city the chance to have a venue that can serve lots of different purposes besides, you know, bringing the world's game to D.C. And we, you know, certainly we believe that it can be the best and the shining star and for the sport in this country. But I think we believe that it's going to do much more than that.
That was VOA's Daniel Brown in an interview with Craig Stufer, the director of communications for D.C. United. In pro basketball news, ESPN reports that talks between the Chicago Bulls and Minnesota Timberwolves surrounding forward Kevin Love threaten to derail talk of a new formed Big Three in Cleveland. The Cavaliers are offering number one overall draft pick Andrew Wiggins and 2013 top pick Anthony Bennett to acquire Love from the Timberwolves, but Chicago is still in the picture. Finally, Emmanuel Mudiay has agreed to a one-year, $1.2 million contract with Guangdong of the China Basketball Association, the richest overseas contract ever for a high school player. The 19-year-old Mudiay had been faced with eligibility issues for his freshman season at Southern Methodist University under Hall of Fame coach Larry Brown, and made the decision to play in China before becoming eligible for the 2015 NBA draft. Mudiay, a 6'5" guard, is considered a lottery pick in the class of 2015. Sources suggest with the Chinese season ending in March, Mudiay's plan will be to return to the U.S. and use the remaining few months to prepare for the 2015 draft in June. Mudiay has also taken out insurance policies to protect him in China against injury that could impact his future earnings. Well, folks, that's about all time will permit us for today on the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Peter Clotty. Back to you, King.
Okay, thank you, Peter. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
In our feature segment, our special VOA Presents series on AIDS, and next, refugee children from Central African Republic not getting the education they need in Cameroon. But first, some music. This evening, we remember popular female Somali singer and current Member of Parliament, Sado Ali Warsami, who was killed today in Mogadishu by gunmen. In memory of Sado Ali, we invite you to listen to one of her many popular compositions, Kudu Wari Laha.
Anigu wanku daurila, kusoto weila, adabtan kugu qaban laha wadnaqan ku dhexgelin laha korkan kugu dhashan laha wadnaqan ku dhexgelin laha korkan kugu dhashan laha damankaa odan kaada duuma damankaa odan kaada duuma wadnaqan ku dhexgelin laha korkan kugu dhashan laha wadnaqan ku dhexgelin laha korkan kugu dhashan laha damankaa odan kaada duuma damankaa odan kaada duuma aha helle oho
Laha, sang by popular female Somali singer and current member of parliament Sado Ali Warasami, who was killed today in Mogadishu by gunmen.
Well, researchers are gathered in Melbourne, Australia for an international meeting on HIV/AIDS this week to share the latest on the search for a treatment and cure for the disease and its co-infections. This week in our special BOA Presents series, part three shows how AIDS is affecting different groups around the world. For decades, the Caribbean nation of Haiti has been plagued with the highest prevalence of HIV in the Western Hemisphere. Consequently, more than 100,000 children have been orphaned. Many contracted the virus from their mothers. We meet one young woman who has worked tirelessly to overcome hardships in her life, including shame of being orphaned and HIV positive.
In Haiti, two children are born with HIV every day. 20-year-old Venice Luis's parents died from AIDS when she was 11. Orphaned, she went to live with an aunt. Several years later, she suspected something might be wrong with her.
I was getting sick often, and they took me to get an HIV test when I was 14. And that is when they found out I am positive. And my aunt's boyfriend said that I cannot stay in the house because I would infect the other children.
Venice now lives at an orphanage run by the organization caring for Haitian orphans with AIDS, along with 18 other HIV-positive children. In Haiti, the stigma of being HIV-positive runs deep. After her diagnosis, Venice suffered cruel mental and physical abuse.
My aunt's boyfriend told her to separate everything I used, silverware, glasses, soap. I slept in a separate part of the house, and I couldn't play with the other kids.
Each morning, Venice prepares for school with the other children. Her aunt would not allow her to get an education, fearing a cut or scrape would infect another child. At the age of 20, she is now finishing the fourth grade. When she first arrived at the orphanage, she was shy, withdrawn, and cried a lot.
I did not feel good at all. I did not feel like a normal person. And by the way my aunt treated me, I thought life wasn't meant to be good for me.
The children are given antiretroviral medication twice a day. The niece arrived at the orphanage weak and physically underdeveloped. After she was diagnosed, she begged her aunt to take her for treatment.
I used to cry a lot every day. My aunt told me the only way I'm going to get treatment is under the earth when I'm dead.
Eventually, the niece received sporadic treatment at a hospital. She also met with a psychologist about the abuse she was suffering.
They told me that if I did not do what they say, they will kick me out of the house and I will be in the street like a prostitute sleeping with men, and they will not accept me back.
It was the psychologist who suggested she be placed in the care of the orphanage, and her life began to change.
When she started getting regular treatment, she started to gain weight. She started to get better physically and mentally.
Two of Venice's aunts agreed to visit her at our request. Her aunt, Janice, denies that there was any abuse.
If somebody told you that, it is not true, especially when she was sick. We never abused her.
Venice remembers things differently.
If they say they did not do that, then they are lying, because they did.
Her aunts want to put the past behind, but Venice still harbors too much pain and anguish.
When I become older, I will let them know what they did to me was wrong. For now, I want to finish school, learn a trade, and never go back to live with my family again.
That was part three of our VOA Presents series on AIDS.
Thousands of Central African children who have fled violence in their country to seek safety in Cameroon are not getting the education they need. With little money coming in, relief workers can only do the barest minimum, such as teach children songs and handwork. From Yaoundé, Eugene Noforengwa reports.
Thousands of Central Africans continue arriving in eastern Cameroon as refugees, more than 18 months since a coup d'etat sparked a cycle of killings in their country. This year alone, more than 106,000 Central Africans crossed the border. Relief workers expect the number to reach 180,000 by the end of the year. The vast majority of them, about 60%, are children who have now been put out of school. Refugee camps have mushroomed along Cameroon's eastern border and challenge officials who must try to educate young residents as all the life-threatening emergency rage on: malnutrition, sanitation, and personal security from violence. Every morning, hundreds of children squat and march on the large white tents in the Gado Badzere camp to sing and recite rhymes. It's their only chance to forget the mayhem back home and the atrocities they have encountered during their flight. The learning and recreation areas are called child-friendly zones, and they were carved out by UNICEF and run by a local organization. Many of those who care for the children are unpaid volunteers recruited from the ranks of the refugees themselves. Zainabu Caleb was a tailor before the killings began, and she fled. She is one of a dozen refugees who have been drafted to supervise children and teach basic skills at the camp, which is home to over 13,000 refugees. Caleb says most of the children would like to be in school, but don't have the opportunity. She says at the child-friendly zone, boys learn how to make wooden toys and girls how to sew. They also listen to educational talks on a variety of subjects. UNICEF, which has been looking out for the welfare of young refugees, says education is an important priority. Only 3% of all children of school-going age in refugee camps have ever been to school. Felicite Chibindat is UNICEF's resident representative in the capital, Yaoundé. She says it will be hard to put them in local schools in Cameroon.
We decided to take this option of a temporary space to start preparing them, and we do have accelerated curricula to help them go to school. And then those who have been in school, we have to evaluate the level and see in which class they should be. Before that, we need space for children to start rebuilding, getting their life back to normal.
The program seems to be paying off. Children are beginning to master different skills. Some have developed self-confidence and are willing to walk forward and perform recitations.
M-M-O-P, fella écoute, il veut tout bébé, la
The number of children attending educational and recreational activity has been growing because parents themselves see the importance of education. But Chibinda says critical obstacles remain.
But the biggest phase will be how do we increase the capacity of the different schools in the community so that they are able. We know already that in this region it's a priority education region, meaning that fewer classroom, fewer teacher and all that. So
lack of resources could hamper the plans of organizations like UNICEF. With so many crises in the world, the plight of Central African refugees appeared to be getting very little attention from donors. UNICEF, for example, says it needs around $25 million for all its interventions this year. But halfway through the year, only 15% has come in. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Eugene Fungwa in Yaoundé, Cameroon.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopez, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Working in partnership with international institutions, non-governmental organizations, private foundations, and governments, the United States has for many years worked to reduce child and maternal deaths. Our combined efforts have not been in vain. Between 1990 and 2012, child deaths have decreased by half. Nonetheless, every year, 289,000 mothers die as a result of childbirth, and 6.6 million children do not survive to their fifth birthday. So, 2 years ago, the governments of Ethiopia, India, and the United States, in collaboration with UNICEF, hosted a child survival call to action, a sustained global effort to save children's lives. The goal was to end preventable child deaths by the year 2035 and to continue progress in those nations already below that rate. Since then, 177 nations and over 450 organizations stepped up to join the effort. Recently, USAID joined with the governments of Ethiopia, India, in collaboration with UNICEF and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, to celebrate progress over the past 2 years and accelerate action to achieve our goal. The occasion was dubbed Acting on the Call, Ending Preventable Child and Maternal Deaths. USAID examined the results of its past efforts, as well as the situation on the ground, and launched an action plan to accelerate progress toward the ultimate goal of eliminating preventable child and maternal deaths. In this plan, USAID outlines how it will work with partners to save the lives of 15 million children and 600,000 women by 2020. Many of the countries that have taken part in U.S.-supported child and maternal health programs have made enormous progress. Thus, over the next 2 years, the United States will realign $2.9 billion in funding and focus efforts in 24 countries that today account for more than 70% of maternal and child deaths and half of the global unmet need for family planning. This move will allow USAID to save an additional 500,000 child lives, said Dr. Rajiv Shah, administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. We are partnering with engines of innovation, corporations, foundations, NGOs, faith-based communities, entrepreneurs, and local leaders to solve one of the greatest development challenges: ending extreme poverty and building thriving, resilient societies. We know that by working with the global community, we can end preventable child and maternal deaths.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Africa Health Network, a multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.